listening to The Ouachita Chronicles.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Ashley. You okay over there?
I'm just kind of tired.
Oh?
It's been a long week, it feels like, except it's like only Tuesday.
Yeah, I feel them pains.
Maybe it's just been a long month.
It's been a long year.
It's February.
It's February, and on the heels of 2020, it just doesn't seem to be getting any better.
Okay, well, maybe my energy level will improve with today's guest. I hope so.
If not, you can always take a nap.
There is a couch in your office.
Well, there's also sofas and beds at Don's Easy Pay.
There are sofas and beds at Don's Easy Pay.
So I say we hop down there and find like a pull-out sofa for the office.
You think they'd be cool with me just napping in the store, though, to test it?
I mean, we are plugging them, so I say we go take naps after the podcast.
Yeah, the Ouachita Chronicles brought to you by Don's Easy Pay. Well, listeners, Don's Easy Pay has absolutely nothing to do with today's guest, except for the fact that today's guest is going to tell us a little bit about an organization that did have houses in MENA. I love history and history about MENA in general.
Absolutely.
And so for a long time, you know, I've known about the Commonwealth College in MENA, but I thought I knew some things about it, as is the case with me always. I think that I know something and it turns out I really did not know.
Don't be knowing.
No, mm-hmm. No, I need more info. But that's why I love that we get to do this show.
Because
I get to learn so many things about stuff that I'm interested in and people I'm interested in. So today's guest is Carrie Byers. Carrie is an adjunct professor of film and television at the U of A in Batesville, and he produced a documentary on MENA's very own Commonwealth College. So we get to visit with him about that and kind of get the background on why he even did this and maybe some info from maybe some of the bloopers or stuff that didn't get put into the documentary. So I'm pretty excited.
I am too. Having not really heard much about the Commonwealth College, it was like a whole new topic of MENA I had not yet explored. So it was a lot of fun for me.
Well, let's meet our guest, Carrie Byers. Welcome to this episode of the Ouachita Chronicles. I'm your host, Ashley Smith, along with my co-host, Jerry.
Hello there.
And we've got a pretty interesting guest in the studio today. Well, we say in the studio, but really on Zoom, because, hey, that's how we communicate with people that aren't in our just regular area here. But we'd like to introduce you to Carrie Byers. Say hi, Carrie.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
Very good. We hope all the listeners are good as well. So Carrie actually put together a documentary on the Commonwealth College that was located right here in the Ouachita Mountains in MENA, Arkansas. And I'm just going to preface this with that a lot of locals here, you know, we're aware that there was a college here. Not many people know really, you know, the ins and outs and the roots of it, of everything. But a lot of us were under the misinformation that the college was located somewhere other than where it actually was. So I don't know if you ran into any of this when you were doing the documentary, but we've got, you know, a little place basically right here in the middle of town that's called College Hill. That's what we've always called it. And almost everyone my age was convinced that that's where the Commonwealth College was at. So I did not even know the correct location until watching your documentary. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, whoa, okay, not even right in the middle of town. So I just have to start with that, because at some point it'd be neat to understand where that, you know, misconception came from. And I don't know if that's something you ran across while you were putting this documentary together, but let's just start with what got you interested in this.
Yeah.
Well, at the time I was, when I first discovered the story of Commonwealth College, I was working as a professor at John Brown University in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. And I was working on a terminal degree, an MFA in film. To sort of advance my career as an academic up there. And I was looking for an interesting topic for a thesis that I wanted to produce, hopefully something that would also potentially, you know, air in public television, which this project eventually led to that. And I started doing research on a topic that interested me at the time, which was rural education in Arkansas and how it was sort of going through its waning years. I mean, school consolidation was a big issue at the time. And what impact was that having on some of these towns? Because once the school goes, the town goes with it. And I'm from Eastern Arkansas. I'm from the flatlands where, you know, mosquitoes swarm you all the time compared to where you guys are in Southwest Arkansas. And I was always interested in this topic because, I mean, some of the Eastern Arkansas farming communities, when their schools went, they became essentially ghost towns. So I wanted to do research on that. Oddly enough, that's not what I wound up doing. In my research online, I came across, I guess I typed in rural and education in Arkansas, And I found the book by Bill Cobb, Rural Education, was it Radical Education in the Rural South? And I found out all about this story of Commonwealth College. And it was this radical, you know, a school that was infiltrated by communists during the Great Depression. And then Orville Faubus went there, the future governor of the state. And a lot of big name people supported it as well. So the more I got into this, I became fascinated with the topic. And that ultimately led to me choosing that for my thesis project. And that's how I got the documentary started.
You're right. Those are some sensational headlines for sure. And, you know, watching your documentary, the word radical is used over and over again because it really truly was. So we'll just kind of start basically from the beginning, you know, how this formed, what you learned, what you uploaded on YouTube for me. You said that the original title was The Little Red School, correct?
Yeah. Initially, that was going to be my title. And as I mentioned earlier, we were talking, I wound up doing a radio version of the documentary, and that was the title I used for it. So then when I re-edited, and there's a slightly different version that aired on AETN, and I decided to rename it with the second choice I went with, which was Southern Utopia, which is kind of going with the Marxist influence and the sort of left-wing influence of the school. Of course, that created a lot of culture clashes at the time. But anyway, I decided to go with that title, and that's the ultimate one that it aired under at AETN.
So just take us through basically, you know, the foundation of this and, you know, a little bit about the two founders we had. What was it? Kate O'Hare was one, correct? Mm-hmm. And then the other, you'll have to pronounce his last name for it.
William Zoik.
Zoik. Okay. I feel like I'm on an episode. Zoik. Yeah, exactly. Bender, Zoik. Okay, got it.
But yeah, well, when I started doing my research, you know, and I, of course, I read Bill Cobb's book. He's also featured in the documentary. I got a chance to interview him. Both Kate Richards O'Hare and William Zoik were socialists. You know, they were big supporters of Eugene V. Debs, a name that maybe not everyone knows today, but a guy who ran for president five different times. And Kate Richards O'Hare was a big supporter of him. And so was Zoik. And, you know, ultimately, you know, Kate Richards O'Hare is kind of an interesting character. You know, she was an activist. Spoke out against World War I during the Wilson administration, actually went to prison for her activities in violation of the Espionage Act. Yeah. And, later on, went on to continue working for socialist causes. I know that William Zoik had worked with her husband in Ruskin College in Florida prior to the creation of Commonwealth College. And the two of them kind of got this idea of a communal school where faculty and students would, you know, live off the land without salaries. It was a low income, easy way to, I guess, get this labor education program off the ground that they wanted to start. And of course, it was an opportunity for them to kind of cultivate, you know, a new class of leadership that they thought would lead to the spread of socialism. And maybe it would ultimately become a viable third party in the 1920s.
So, but they didn't start it originally in Arkansas. Polk County was not their first pick, correct? That's right. Okay, where was that at?
That's correct. The roots of it go all the way back to Southern California, believe it or not. Job Harriman, who had been the running mate of Eugene V. Debs, I think in the 1904 election as running mate, and he wound up migrating to Los Angeles, ran for the mayor a couple of times, almost got elected, actually. And then he started this agricultural cooperative commune where people came together and they worked communally off the land. And not unlike what would follow in Louisiana, you had different factions that erupted. They didn't get along very well, and there was a split. And so Harriman took his people to Leesville, Louisiana, where he met Zoik. And at Leesville, Louisiana is actually where Commonwealth College started. And then they kind of broke apart into different factions there. And then Zoik took his people and went to Polk County. And that's ultimately where they started Commonwealth College, at least what we talk about today.
Why Polk County? Why choose this tiny little town isolated from, you know, nearly everything in Arkansas right here in the mountains? What was the purpose of bringing it here?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because you think about, you know, if the whole idea is to organize labor movements and to organize unions, you think about industrial states like Ohio or Pennsylvania, or maybe you look at, you know, sharecroppers and migrant workers in the agricultural regions in eastern Arkansas. Those areas might have made more sense. But, you know, in my documentary, I talked to Michael Dugan, who at that time was a professor at Arkansas State. And, you know, you talk about the Encyclopedia of Arkansas. This guy is the Encyclopedia of Arkansas. And he was a great, great interview. And he said, basically, you know, they were looking for a place where the land was cheap, they would be isolated, they could go whichever direction they wanted to go with this without having the pressures with local people being opposed to their ideas and creating cultural clashes. Although at the same time, ultimately that's what it led to, because in Polk County, the locals did not share their vision for America, certainly the socialist vision that the leadership and later on the students had it at Commonwealth College.
Right. It makes me wonder if they actually did their research about Polk County and how tolerant, you know, it really was at that time. Not to out our county here, but we don't have a long history of tolerance for sure. So it was an interesting choice. They decided to come here. Yeah. I can agree with their views on the natural beauty and the resources and being able to live off the land. But like you said, it seems like it would have made more sense to go somewhere where that type of organization and those unions were more active.
In the 1930s, of course, that's when they started trying to travel different locations and organize unions in different parts of the country. But you know, it's worth noting, and maybe we'll talk more about this later, but Orville Faubus, who attended there, his dad, Sam Faubus, was a big time socialist activist in Northwest Arkansas. As a matter of fact, Orville Eugene Faubus, his full name, his middle name, he was named after Eugene Debs, who was the socialist candidate for president. And also he had a brother named Carl, named after Karl Marx, and a brother named Darrow, named after Clarence Darrow, the famed attorney who was one of the, you know, early leaders in the ACLU. So definitely Orville Faubus' dad marched to the beat of a different drum. He was even a proponent of integration in Arkansas going back to the 1920s. So yeah, Faubus comes from a tradition that most people do not think of. And of course, there was at least a small, I guess, segment of Arkansans who were progressive at that time, but definitely in Polk County, not that many. In the 20s and 30s, for sure.
Right, right. You know, your documentary mentioned some of the supporters. Albert Einstein was a big supporter of the movement itself, correct? Steinbeck was a donor, correct? And then who did we have sitting on the board? Well, trustee, Upton Sinclair was a trustee. Was there a chance that any of these people ever actually visited the college here in MENA?
Not to my knowledge, they did. There were, now actually, Eleanor Roosevelt visited the campus at one time, if I'm not mistaken. You had Mother Bloor, who was a woman who was a communist activist. She actually visited there as well. But basically, you kind of have to remember, going back to the 1920s, when many of these people like Einstein and Steinbeck were supporting the school, these were not, you know, rabid Stalinist, communist type personalities. They were socialists. And if you go back to the origins of the school, they were not as radical as they became during the Great Depression in the 1930s. When the younger crowd took over under Lucien Cope, that's when they became much more radicalized. And you saw an influx of communists. And once again, you had these factions developing that ultimately would lead to the demise of the college in the latter part of the 1930s. But they were just seeing this as progressive school. It was all about labor education. I'm sure that many of these people also supported the socialist cause as well. But many of these people later on in the 1930s became New Deal Democrats and supported FDR. So that kind of, you know, moderated some of the views of some of these people. And then, of course, some people became more radicalized. And of course, that became an issue later on at the school.
So it also noted in your documentary that tuition was $40 for a semester, that, you know, the students were required to work, 20 hours a week to offset whatever that was and just basically take care of everybody. So what, from your research, what was a typical day for students at Commonwealth College in MENA?
Right. That school was actually, they didn't actually give grades. They didn't give degrees. Attendance wasn't even compulsory, though I'm assuming most of the people went there for that reason. They did attend. Classes typically were very small, anywhere from a half dozen to a dozen students. I know Bill Cobb, in my interview with him, talked about how incredible that must have been. And, you know, being a professor myself, you get a small core group of people who are really motivated by the material. It's a lot of fun getting those discussions and conversations going with your students. Sometimes you learn more from them than they learn from you. But it's interesting, the working part of it, the teachers, the faculty and the students worked equally out in the fields, building the buildings, you know, bringing in the crops, milking the cows, whatever the case may be. But also you may notice that traditional roles were played. If you were a man, you tended to do the farm work and the machinery work. If you were a woman, you were in the library, you were doing the dishes and the laundry. So there are a lot, there's some traditions there in spite of the fact that, you know, it's considered a sort of forward thinking progressive school.
Right, right. It also seems that, well, I mean, you noted also that they held events. I mean, they had lectures, they had plays, they had dances, and that they encouraged the locals to attend those things. So it looks like they've made an effort from the get-go to really incorporate with the community and make friends with all the rural people around here. And did that work out well for a while for them?
Well, it sounded like a lot of people in the community did find these events interesting. They wanted, I know Charlotte Koch talked a little bit about that in some of the archival footage that I used in the documentary, that some of the locals would attend, they'd make friends. Fact is, you know, we talk about, you know, maybe the town being ultra conservative and some of the people there being very radical, but you had moderates on both ends. You had people who met in the middle. So I think there were some people who were probably more welcoming of the commoners to the Polk County and others who are far more resistant to it. But I mean, there must have been some commonality that existed there because they did manage to stay there for 14 years. And it took a while before the community started developing hostilities with the college. And I think a lot of that happened probably because it became more radicalized. As a matter of fact, in the 30s, there was an attempt by some of the more radical elements to integrate the school and bring African-Americans to the campus, which today that sounds like a wonderful idea, and it would have been, but in the 1930s, probably not, you know, and the more moderate elements were resistant to that. So, I mean, there's a couple of different ways you could look at that, but there are a lot of elements at play. You remember a lot of these people too, they came from other parts of the country. A lot of these people were Ivy League educated who came down to work at Commonwealth. You know, culturally, there was a big difference between them and the community. And of course, that would ultimately cause problems down the road.
Hey, Jerry, you know how I was mentioning that I really needed a new couch?
Mm-hmm.
Look at this one I found online.
I mean, that's great and all, but why are you looking for furniture online?
Well, because of the selection and the price. And
that's absolutely ridiculous. You have the same selection and better prices, and you can actually sit and experience the furniture you're going to get for your home at Don's Easy Pay.
Oh, yeah. Aren't they the one who's been family-owned and operated for like 40 years?
Yes, they are, and they offer all the brands you're going to find online. Like Ashley, GE, Whirlpool, Catnapper, Samsung, England Furniture, Speed Queen, and more. If you visit the store and it's not there for you to sit on, and experience, they can special order for you. You can have anything you want there, and the prices are going to really reflect in your pocketbook.
So, like, the same Ashley furniture that I'm looking at online, I can get at Don's?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, what about delivery setup? Because, you know, shopping online, I get delivery.
Yeah, shopping online, then you've got your delivery fees, your shipping fees, taxes, yada, yada, yada. You go to Don's, you see the price tag, taxes included, delivery fee included, any financing options included in the price on the tag. No math.
Okay, well, what about other stuff? What if I don't just need a couch? What else do they have?
Oh my gosh, every major appliance for your washroom, your kitchen. They've even got game systems, vacuums, stuff for home and garden. If you need it for your house, you can go to Don's and get it. You can also go to Don's and get tires. I mean, really, anything that you need, you can get it at Don's.
Well, you know, I'm really hard on my appliances. What if something breaks?
Not to worry, because Don's does all of the appliance work on things that you buy from them. Things like washers, dryers, ranges, refrigerators, and freezers. So you buy it from them, it breaks, they're going to help you out with appliance repair.
Well, this place that I was shopping online, they had like financing options. Does Don's have that too?
Yes, absolutely. All right, so they've got the retail, like if you just buy it, they've got the price there. You can rent to own it, or you can do 180 days same as cash, or you can do 6 months same as cash for anything over $1,000. And all of that has the tax and delivery, everything included in the price.
So the price on the piece is the price that I would be paying.
Yeah, price on the piece is the price that you pay.
All right, so where all is Don's at? I mean, where do I go?
If you live in Arkansas, you're pretty much close to it. I mean, you've got one in Mena, Waldron, DeQueen, Broken Bow, Idabel, Poto, and they're also going to be doing this really cool new home store in Boonville.
So Don's home store in Boonville.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So can I find them online too?
Yeah. So you just get on Facebook and search Don's Easy Pay and then put in your location like Mena or Waldron, Idabel or Boonville. And you can look at their Facebook page, give them a call, find their address, and just stop in and see what they can do for you.
So basically, if I need it for my home, Don's Easy Pay has it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, dude, let's go. Car. Shopping trip.
And that is something in itself to note that the students at Commonwealth were from across the country, were from other countries in some cases. I mean, they were not locals here. They had to actively seek out to attend this place and come to Mena, Arkansas, you know, to go to school here. What your documentary said something about a family moving from Oregon just so they could attend this school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and that's not the only case of things like that, right? That was basically the norm with those students.
Right. Yeah, I think the story of Charlotte and Raymond Cope is pretty a good example of what you're talking about, because it was Raymond Koch's family who moved from Oregon all the way to Arkansas to participate at Commonwealth College. And of course, he was a student. His brother Lucien was a student. Lucien became the director later on in the school, and he stayed on to be a faculty member as well. Then he married Charlotte Moskowitz, who was from New York, you know, opposite ends of the entire continent, not just the country. And they came together there. And of course, you know, just looking at the footage, I didn't get a chance to interview them. That was actually Dale Carpenter, a guy I got to know when I worked in Northwest Arkansas. He was a documentary filmmaker. He He was a professor at the U of A who, along with Larry Foley, they do a lot of documentaries. And he had a chance to talk to them. And you could tell those people really had a bond. They had a very happy marriage. At least I got that vibe from watching, you know, the video of them. And so obviously there was something that brought people from different cultures, different backgrounds together because they believed in the same cause.
Yeah, for sure. I can definitely see that. And they seemed, you know, when they were recounting their time there at the college, it seemed to be happy memories for them. I mean, you know, we didn't get to see all the footage because obviously there's blooper reels, but they seemed like they truly enjoyed their time and made those connections for sure. Yeah. But talking about Lucien, so what led to a revolt? Mm-hmm. What led to the students revolting against the director and deciding, hey, we're taking over. We don't like the way this is going.
I think there are several factors. I mean, Zoic, I think, saw education at Commonwealth as sort of an extension of traditional liberal arts education. And to him, he was focusing more on the theoretical, perhaps, than the actual practical application of what was being taught there. And it wasn't enough change to satisfy a lot of the people who went there. They wanted to go out and get in the fields and organize unions and change the world. And so you had a generational clash there. You know, some people were maybe more extreme, more moderate in their views. The more moderate wing was represented by Zoic. The more aggressive or radical wing, if you want to use that, was represented by Lucien Koch. And ultimately, he emerged as, I guess, the consensus choice to become the leader of the campus. You know, in the documentary, I talk about he led delegations to the coal mines of Eastern Kentucky and to other parts of the country. Of course, they under him, the beginnings of the relationship between the Southern Tenant Farmers Union and Commonwealth College developed, where they were organizing unions in Eastern Arkansas, sharecroppers, and perhaps in some cases, migrant workers. So once again, they were wanting more drastic change to be affected by Commonwealth. And of course, you also have to take into account after 1929, the stock market crash, the Great Depression probably led to more radicalization. And I'll be honest, I mean, some of these people were communists. They looked at Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union as what they thought was the ideal for us. And I'm fascinated by this. And I love the topic. I love making the documentary. Knowing what Stalin did, that was not a wise decision. Of course, when I started, you know, I think Harold Coogan, who's from MENA, I interviewed him as well. And he talked in the documentary about where they had a hammer and sickle emblem that they had in one of the buildings on campus, which caused a lot of, you know, controversy in the local community. And I think Lucien Koch had said, well, the hammer and sickle accidentally fell in the cement and it just landed that way. But no, these people actually look to Russia as maybe where we should be moving. However, I try to put this in perspective. Of course, there's a big movement now to tear down statues and this sort of thing and to rewrite our history. I try to look at those guys within the context of what they knew. And there was a lot they didn't know. You know, it's between the two world wars. You have the rise of fascism in Germany and Italy and then communism in Russia. And there was a lot they didn't know at that point about just how dangerous that could be. So I think, you know, there's more to the story. And I try to judge them based on what they knew at the time. Because, I mean, Orville Faubus, who would have thought he would have gone on to be governor 20 years later? And he was pretty left-wing in his politics. And I can guarantee you, had he campaigned in the 1950s on what he probably believed in the 1930s, he would not have been governor of Arkansas.
No. And it's very interesting coming from that type of background. And well, we'll just say making the very big mistake that he made. We'll just put it like that.
Which is really odd considering he came from Commonwealth College.
Right. Exactly. You know, that his background versus that decision. Yeah. It's totally like it's a divide right there that I just can't wrap my mind around for sure. Some of the other things that were very interesting to me that you noted in there were the free love that was associated with this.
Yeah.
The communal living. I mean, I know that was not obviously very popular at the time, but one of the articles that, you know, had run across your documentary was nude bathing parties. I mean, where were these accusations coming out of? Were those coming from locals or were those accusations that were, you know, made by these other parties that were trying to shut the college down?
Well, I mean, obviously the locals were making that accusation. To what extent that happened, you know, I didn't go that much into that aspect of the story, but it does sound like that there were some skinny dipping that went on. And you know, obviously these were not conservative, in some cases not Christian, I mean, people who were going to adhere to the local mores of Southwest Arkansas in the 1930s. So I have no doubt that some activities went on that were contradictory to what would be expected in Polk County at that time. But if I can name names and tell you incidents that happened, I can't really name them. But there apparently were incidences where people were out skinny dipping. Although, you know, my goodness, you know, a lot of kids growing up in the country skinny dipped as well. What else happened beyond that? I wish I had a National Enquirer story for you here, but I don't really have one.
Right. That was what was so interesting about it, because I could get that, you know, they were the communist scare, the atheism, et cetera. But when they just kind of started bringing, you know, the whole free love thing into it, I was like, all right, well, somebody was out there spying on the college kids is all I can think.
He was pretty blunt. And in one of the interviews, he admitted he was an atheist and views that obviously would have alienated the locals. I'm not sure he was the most diplomatic person. And of course, we get to Claude Williams at the end of Commonwealth College, who, oddly enough, was a Presbyterian minister and a communist. And I was reading one of the articles recently. I was delving back into this. Supposedly, he had on his wall a picture of Lenin and Jesus and Eugene V. Debs. So, I mean, he had some unorthodox views that were either going to pull everybody together or alienate everybody because religion and communism, at least in most places, don't go together very well.
Right. It seems that in the beginning, they were trying to keep a low profile, integrate into the community, make friends with their neighbors. And then by the time that basically the mutiny had happened, and then what was one of the labor parties that basically said and put Claude Williams in place, is that correct? How was he made director?
Yeah, initially he was supported by the STFU, who had built this sort of, you know, I guess they had built sort of a coalition with the college because they were training some of the members of the STFU, the Southern Tenant Farmers Union in Tyronza, which is near Memphis. And they built this sort of relationship between the school and the union. And Claude Williams was an activist who both sides, I guess, basically coalesced around and agreed to make him the new director. They thought he would be able to sort of get the ship back on course. And in fact, it turned out to be the worst decision they could have made because Claude Williams was a communist. I mean, he had strong communist beliefs. And, you know, of course, there was a controversy that took place where they felt at the STFU that he was attempting to infiltrate their union with communists and take over the union for the Communist Party USA, and that ultimately led to his downfall, a Commonwealth, and it ultimately alienated the Southern Tenant Farmers Union and the support that they had enjoyed from them in the past.
Right, right. So they went from trying to fit in to just not caring and putting someone in place who, you know, was basically going to continue to throw up those red flags towards the beginning of the downfall of the school. And this was something that I really wanted to rewatch your documentary several times in this part to really understand what finally put the school under. Because was there basically some kind of like a headhunt by one of the local Baptist preachers here, or did it have more to do with Claude Williams himself?
I think it was alienating the moderate support that they enjoyed, like the STFU. I think the fact that they were being pressured by L.D. Sumners, who was the local pastor at that time, that he was leading opposition to shut the school down. Of course, you know, the people that were out to get, if you will, Commonwealth College, there was accusations that they were violating ordinances. They weren't flying the American flag when they were supposed to. They were displaying the hammer and sickle of the Soviet Union. They're having May Day celebrations, you know. They probably didn't have a Christmas celebration, but they had a May Day celebration. But those kinds of things, of course, you know, culturally, it alienated people. And organizations that were already worried about being called communists, like labor unions, for example, they didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole because, you know, they thought they were being tainted by Claude Williams and Commonwealth when at first they enjoyed the support of the college. So I think all those things came together. And when they were sued for these, you know, supposed illegal activities, there were several fines they were levied with, and the school just didn't have the money to pay it. And the people who had supported them in the past, going back to Einstein and H.L. Mencken and Upton Sinclair, they were okay with supporting a socialist labor school, not so much a radical communist school.
Right.
So they basically ran out of money, they ran out of support, and the community no longer wanted them there. So it created a perfect storm, and it was the end of the school, basically.
Before they completely shut down, though, they had tried to transition into a different model, correct? They tried to turn themselves into a drama center.
Yeah. There were different options they were looking at. I think it was the Highlander Folk School had mentioned taking them over as a sister campus. But ultimately, they did have an option with the New Theater League in New York. Now, this was, you know, my goodness, John Garfield, who went on to be a Hollywood movie star, was a member of the New Theater League. You know, this is like Ilya Kazan, some of these people who became famous in Hollywood later on. They were wanting to locate a school to train directors and screenwriters and actors in Mena, Arkansas to promote the socialist cause. That would have been kind of interesting. It makes me wonder what would have happened if that had actually unfolded, you know?
It
didn't occur. Well, I guess we'll always wonder. But you think about all the people who got in trouble in Hollywood later on, you know, like Dalton Trumbo and people like that. That's probably the kind of people they would have been educating in Mena in the 1940s had it continued to exist.
For sure. But the only thing that might be more absurd to me than a Commonwealth College in Mena would be a drama center in Mena. Now, we've got the history of the arts. We've got a lot of people involved in that. But during that time period specifically, I mean, we still complain about having to drive an hour and a half away to buy alcohol, okay, because we're in a dry county, or an hour and a half away to go shopping. But somebody traveling here to go to drama school, that would just tickle me pink for sure. Mm-hmm. I love that. So Commonwealth actually ceased in existence in 1940, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so 14.
Yeah, that was pretty much the end of the line. You know, they basically ran out of money, they ran out of support, and they kind of ran out of a purpose. If the labor unions no longer wanted to touch them because they were toxic, and you know, they couldn't bring the new theater league down to MENA to start a new program, and then none of the major donors wanted to finance the school anymore. And of course, you have to remember what's going on in the world at this time. You know, World War II is starting. The New Deal is in its, you know, full effect under FDR. The need for Commonwealth College became less and less important. Obviously, the war brought back the economy, and things we found out about Stalin after the war would have probably alienated a lot of those points of view as well. And, you know, we talk about the arts back then. You know, Hollywood was very conservative back then. Think about today, Hollywood's so liberal. Hollywood was not liberal in the 30s and 40s. It was very conservative. So I think they were out of touch with a lot of the country as we started to move out of the Depression and into the World War II era and ultimately the Cold War. And I just don't see, ultimately, to quote Roy Reed in the documentary, I just don't see ultimately how it could have lasted in that part of Arkansas at that time.
As they said, doomed from the beginning, for sure. Picked a beautiful place to put it. Yeah. But like you said, the need was not there anymore. I love that you mentioned Mr. Coogan. We give him a big shout out around here. I mean, he was one of my teachers. His son was one of my teachers. I actually grew up right next door to his vacation cabin on the river. So I've known Mr. Coogan since I was like 12. We give him a hard time every single time we see him. But he is the MENA historian for sure. So we don't know if he's listening to this or not. But if so, what's up, Mr. Coogan? We're all saying hi to you. We're talking about you, even if you don't know that we are. So before I was in this position that I'm in now, I actually was at the Chamber of Commerce here in MENA for several years and handled tourism here. And Barbara Lewis had reached out to me and she said, Ashley, you've got to check this out. They have found some panels in this closet of this house here in MENA that were actually originally located at the Commonwealth College. And they're coming to, you know, get them and hopefully restore them or preserve them and display them. Did you have any part to do with that? Was that while you were making your documentary? Because she was equating the two together.
No, I don't remember any of that, actually. That's all news to me. I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, that's something that we will fast fact. We always do fast facts on the show. Yeah. Anything that we really weren't sure of. So I'll get in touch with her and find out what that deal was, because if I remember the story correctly, somebody remodeled a house and in an upstairs closet, when they started to peel back paneling or wallpaper, they had come across these gorgeous mural panels that were supposedly
there. So update me on that one. That's interesting. Yeah,
we'll definitely look into it and we'll try to fast fact it. And that way, whenever you listen to the episode, hopefully it'll have something on there.
Okay, cool. I was going to, a story I wanted to tell you though, which is kind of an offbeat fun thing that I remember, thanks to Mr. Coogan, I was able to go out to the Ansada Arabian Horse Farm?
Mm-hmm.
Where the campus used to be. And a beautiful location, as you mentioned. But what was interesting, apparently if I'd been there a week earlier, Patrick Swayze was there looking at horses. And I just missed Patrick Swayze when I was doing my research. And that's a little side note that was kind of cool. So, you know, I think my wife was more upset about us not being there than I was at the time. But
Patrick Swayze did come into town to buy horses here. We've got a restaurant just down the street from us that they've got a photo with him where he came in to eat and he signed it for him and everything. So, you know, those Egyptian horses, a pretty high dollar, and they brought some people to MENA that you wouldn't quite expect for sure. But yeah, Mr. Coogan, he likes to make all of us feel bad on things we missed out on. Yeah. He's just that kind of guy for sure. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, do you have anything else to note, or are we ready for us to wrap it up? Was there anything pertinent you think we missed that we really need to point out?
Not really necessarily. As I mentioned earlier, the Orville Faubus thing just kind of sticks with me, you know, and I don't know if you want me to go into that or not.
Yeah, anything.
Just the whole thing. Because, you know, we look back at him and maybe it's a black eye in Arkansas history because of, you know, the Little Rock Central crisis, which, you know, history has not treated him well for obvious reasons. But it's funny that the guy who was Arkansas governor at that time came from this strong progressive background and he winds up getting elected during the McCarthy era, when they were trying to out communists all over the country and in the government, in Hollywood, et cetera. And he somehow manages to hang on and get elected. And I did read this about him. Roy Reed, who I interviewed in the documentary, wrote a great biography of Orville Faubus. But apparently the whole integration issue really was a sticking point between him and his dad, who was very upset with Orville for what he did. I tend to think that Faubus was acting out of political opportunism. I wonder if he really believed what he did at the time. Not that that excuses him. It probably damns him more, because if you know it's wrong, you go with it and you do it, then you're going to pay the price for it. But, you know, Arkansas is a fascinating history of the pendulum swinging from one side to the other politically. And you go from Faubus to Winthrop Rockefeller, who's a liberal Republican. And then it cuts back to, you know, the Bill Clinton era, then the Mike Huckabee era. Arkansas has a very interesting history. So the fact that you have these sort of polar opposite points of view in MENA from the commoners and the locals, it probably should not surprise us, because I think Arkansas has a long history of all kinds of point of views. And we tend to swing from one side to the other. But hopefully, ultimately, we get it right.
So how about if it's lunchtime? What are we going to have from Wendy's?
You know, I really like Dave's Double for Lunch.
I really like their pub fries.
Yes, pub fries are delicious.
No, dude, the pub fries have a warm beer, cheese sauce, and applewood smoked bacon. Do you know what else they have the lockdown on?
What's that?
Rewards.
Rewards? I'm all about some rewards. Tell me.
You can download their app and you get 10 points for every dollar you spend at Wendy's. And right now, you get $3 off every mobile order over $15.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me you could have gotten breakfast for me with a 2-for-4 deal. You could have gotten breakfast for the entire office with a 2-for-4 deal, spent over $15 and then gotten $3 off and fed us all.
Jerry, it's that time. You're going to have to be an adult. You need to download the Wendy's app yourself.
Ugh. Well, it doesn't seem that difficult, so I guess this is my opportunity to start doing things for myself.
That's exactly what you should do, because with the Wendy's app, you can order online, you can view the menu, or you can just locate the Wendy's nearest you.
But can we have Producer Trey pick it up for us?
We could have Producer Trey pick it up, or they will actually deliver.
True.
Yeah, for sure.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So if you're like us and you love Wendy's and you need more in your life, make sure and visit the Wendy's location nearest you. Because remember, Wendy's is always fresh, always hot, and always satisfying.
So was it either when he was running for election or re-election that it was brought up that he attended Commonwealth? And he said, well, he was only there for a short time. How short of a time was it? Because it seemed like he really emphasized that he was only there for a short time.
My understanding, he was there for a year and he got elected student government president. And
just a short time.
And there's that one picture, I believe that was Charlotte Koch who's in that picture with him, where he's wearing the overalls, he's got like his arm around her, and he's posing with a hat on. Yeah, one of the interviewees, I don't remember if it was Bill Cobb or Roy Reed, but one of them said that she always denied that was her in the picture. But, you know, if you look at the picture, it does kind of look like her, so I don't know.
All right, well, Carrie, if people would like to watch the documentary, can they still find it on YouTube? Is it going to stay up there?
Yeah, it's there for right now, but I'd like to update my... full quality, the one that actually aired on AETN. I've got that one. And I think if you Google Commonwealth College right now, you can find it. I don't have a problem with people watching if they want to.
Okay.
But I think ultimately I'm going to replace it with that.
Yeah, definitely. We'll put that link there. Well, Carrie, we just want to say thank you very much for taking some time to visit with us today and sharing your expertise on this very, very interesting topic and a very interesting part of MENA's history that, as I said, a lot of us were misinformed about either on what the location of it was or just what the purpose was. Commonwealth College is something that, you know, we've always heard about growing up here in MENA, except for Jerry. She's from Louisiana, so I got to give her a break. But we definitely will direct people to watch the documentary, and we love that you did this. It was a great thing, and we thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad people are still interested in it, because it was something I really enjoyed working on.
So normally, it would be time for that portion of our show that we call Fast Facts with Producer Trey. But due to some of the technical difficulties and lag that we had while interviewing Carrie Byers today, we completely flaked and forgot to do our lightning round.
Wah, wah.
Trey, you don't need sound effects. You have Jerry. So we decided, since we totally forgot, that we would just lightning round each other real quick.
Oh my gosh. Is that what we decided?
That's what we decided. All right. Jerry, what's your favorite color?
I don't have one. I don't have a favorite anything, which leaves me in a position of complete objectivity when reporting.
Whoa.
My favorite color is seafoam green. I'm just going to throw it out there because you're trying to be difficult.
I really have never had a favorite anything.
You just blew my mind there, Jerry.
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
You've never had a favorite anything?
Mm-mm.
Well, your turn. Lob one at me.
If you could be any animal, what would you be?
Any animal. You know, I would either be a really, really spoiled house cat or a dolphin.
That dolphin goes kind of with that favorite color. See, what was
it? Yeah. Seafoam Green. I love anything to do with the ocean, but, you know, the fact that according to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that dolphins are the second smartest being in the universe.
Yep, second smartest.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
Mm-hmm.
So but
make sure you bring a towel.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I'd have the smoothest skin. That'd be amazing. And I get to glide through the water.
And dance. I love that they dance.
And did you know a little weird tidbit about dolphins? They actually use puffer fish as like an intoxicant.
An intoxicant?
Like they're getting high off puffer fish.
Yeah, oh.
That's true.
Do you think that dolphins are forming like support groups for puffer fish addiction?
No, but I do think that squirrels are trying to take over the world.
Whoa, that was straight out of left field.
Okay, Jerry, what's the last book you read?
Oof. The Gene Keys. I don't know who wrote it. Favorite author is Terry Goodkind, who wrote the Sword of Truth series. That's my favorite fantasy book series. What three people you would invite to your dinner party?
Super easy. I've thought about this a lot. My grandmother, who I miss dearly, Bill Clinton, and Buddha.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. I want Bill Clinton to charm the pants off everybody. I want Buddha to...
Does Buddha wear pants?
No, so that was taken care of.
No, he doesn't wear pants.
He's got an easy job right there. I want Buddha to impart some knowledge and some peace in my life, and I want to have one last drink with my grandma.
Aw, that's pretty cool.
She's awesome. Shout out to Nancy. So today's episode with Carrie Byers about his documentary on the Commonwealth College. Super interesting stuff. Like, I loved it. Like, we watched the documentary several times to kind of prepare for this. But as I said, there's so many things I think I know about and I don't. And first of all, was the fact that the location was in a completely different part of the county than what I thought it was. I'm all convinced it's right up here on College Hill in the middle of MENA. Nope. It was out at Ansada. So that was really cool for me.
I just love that it shows that it doesn't matter where you're at in the world, anywhere in the world, if you get people together who want to think, who want to discuss, it can happen. And you can have a variety of opinions and ideas on economics, on diplomacy, on government, and have these ideas come to the table to be discussed. And that doesn't have to happen in a metropolitan area. It can happen in Egypt.
Well, they didn't outright say it, but I mean, from what I gleaned from, you know, the documentary and speaking with Carrie, is that the classes there were, you know, very much like the Socratic method.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very cool. I like that. Obviously, we like discussion or we wouldn't be sitting here bantering back and forth about all kinds of things. So, I mean, that trips our trigger. We like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Byers was very knowledgeable, and I love that he produced this documentary, and it's a great thing. As he mentioned, you can go see it on YouTube. So you can just search Commonwealth College MENA on YouTube. And it should pop up. It's definitely worth 30 minutes of your time to watch for sure. Getting close to the end of our interview with him, I had a question for him and it caught him completely off guard. He was not aware of this new development in relation to the Commonwealth College. And I actually learned about this a few years ago from Barbara Lewis, who's very involved with the art gallery here in MENA. But she had told me, Ashley, they found these panels, this mural, they're being restored, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to be on display in Little Rock. And they were out of the Commonwealth College. And in my mind, I had basically married that together with Mr. Byers, thinking he had something to do with that or at least had some knowledge of it. But as I said, caught him completely off guard. So I had producer Trey check into this, and I hope that Carrie listens to this episode so he can get the lowdown on that because he wanted to be updated on it. So lay it on us, producer Trey.
There was an artist that was named Joe Jones, and he painted a mural showing the misery of sharecropping, the plight of coal miners, and the lynching and burning of a black man, the three exports of Arkansas. That's dark.
It's a very dark mural.
It stayed up for 5 years and then was dismantled along with the college and became Depression-era building material for a closet in a house in MENA.
That's kind of crazy. But, you know, they used what they had on hand. So.
And they never threw anything away. They always repurposed stuff because materials, everything was so hard to come by. And even if you could come by, you didn't have the money. So right. Mural becomes wall paneling.
There you go.
So the artist traveled across Arkansas taking pictures of things to include in the mural that he made. He saw coal miners in Paris, which in the 1930s had below-ground coal mining and sharecroppers in the Delta. He knew about Arkansas's history of lynching. The last documented one had occurred only 8 years earlier and had painted imagery of lynching previously. From MENA, Jones wrote a patron in St. Louis that the food was bad. Little meat, he said, but there was a good swimming hole. He wrote that there was no question the mural will be the most important one in the lower half of the United States, as well as important nationally.
So he didn't like our food, but he liked our crystal clear water.
Mm-hmm.
44 years after the college closed, Bobby Roberts got a call from William Cravens, who lived in Fort Smith. He was the son of Congressman William Faggio Cravens, about the mural. When he went to grab the mural, he found it lying in 29 pieces in a yard, and he paid $500 for it and brought it back to U of A in Little Rock. It was so fragile, ripped with water damage in places, frayed masonite and others, paint cracked like eggshells, that it was covered in brown craft paper, tucked away in a permanent collection storage, and not taken out to show students.
So, the mural was uncovered, this guy went to rescue it, but then it just got put away again, correct?
From what I gather, yes.
Okay.
And then another 26 years passed, and Cushman, who was the gallery director at the time, got a call from the St. Louis Museum of Art, which was doing a Jones retrospective and wondered if U of A Little Rock did indeed have the mural, as a book on Commonwealth said it had. And they offered to restore the central panels of the mural showing the lynching at their own cost, and U of A agreed.
Wow. Dark mural for sure, but it's a major part of history. Mm-hmm. Well, anything else on it?
Yeah, the mural was once in a dining hall at Commonwealth. Cushman said that it stimulated a lot of conversation, so it kind of makes sense that it's down there on Main Street, and the conversation is going to continue. Right now, the mural can be seen at the Central Arkansas Library System office building on Clinton Avenue in Little Rock.
Sounds like a field trip to me at some point.
I say we go. That I would really love to see that.
I would love to know more about the dimensions of it, but that's definitely, I mean, you can do a search for that mural and find some news articles, and I feel like I need to check with Barbara Lewis and see if there was like another documentary that was created around just the panels and that whole thing. Definitely something to dive into. Mm-hmm. But if that was to happen, to stay in the episode about a little bit of the dark history of MENA, I would specifically want to point out that that college was not created to be a dark place. It was created to be a wellspring of thought and discussion and, gosh, even free love. You don't know how many backwoods hillbilly hippies were around here thinking whatever they wanted to think.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Arkansas was a refuge for people, you know, running from the East for a very long time. And you think about the moonshiners and the bootleggers, like mm-hmm. in the Appalachia.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the Washitas here. You had to be really tough to survive here, and you had to want to kind of be outside of the law. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pretty cool stuff.
Which is why I think it was so funny when it wasn't it Hoover
that pardoned?
That pardoned, and then wasn't it
the one of the co-founders? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no, there's no Red Scare. There's no communism even discussed here. Not mm-hmm. what look the other way. And at the time was FBI director and then went on to become president and is all tied up with all kinds of conspiracies mm-hmm. and stuff.
All right. So, as always, thank you for listening to the Washita Chronicles, brought to you by Dawn's Easy Pay and Dawn's Home Store. You can find us along with other great shows at thewashitapodcast.com. Contact us at thewashitapodcast@gmail.com and make sure you find us on Facebook and Instagram and give us a like. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast streaming platform, please give us a rating because it helps us show up higher in the search on there. And we just want to be able to continue to tell some awesome stories. So until next time, Ashley and Jerry
out.
Thank you for listening to the Washita Chronicles.